Group Retirement Products. That's why we're your retirement company.
It's 9:30. You're tuned to Coast Community Radio. Stay tuned for To Your Health.
To Your Health is brought to you in part by Providence Seaside Hospital and North Coast Clinics, with locations in Warrenton, Seaside and Cannon Beach, and Providence Heart Clinics in Astoria and Seaside. Healthcare is close to home. Information at 503-717-7000.
Good morning. Welcome to Your Health. I'm Ann Goldin, and this week I have Liz Covey, who is a licensed professional counselor at Hope House, which is a subsidiary or a part of Lutheran Family Services that offers counseling services in Astoria that are affordable and on a sliding scale, or a no scale, depending on your scale. And we're going to talk about children and trauma. She specializes in working with children that have been traumatized. Good morning, Liz.
Good morning, Ann.
So, where shall we start?
Well, maybe I could describe a class that we're going to be offering in January. I'm very excited. We just got our dates secured and our location. We're going to be offering a class that we've offered a few times in the community before. It's actually a PowerPoint presentation that we offer with a lot more additional, you know, we sort of
fill it out,
yeah, mm-hmm. with experiential, you know, information about working with kids and trauma. And that presentation is through the National Child Traumatic Stress Network, which is a great clearinghouse. And they actually have a really good website for people who want to, you know, kind of research what we're talking about a little bit further. Mm-hmm. And I believe it's just nctsn.org. The class itself is called Working with Children Who've Experienced Stress. Oh, I'm sorry. Caring for Children Who Have Experienced Trauma. So it's really a wonderful class. We're going to do it over two evenings, January 22nd and January 29th at the Guy Boyington Building.
Uh-huh. So right downtown Astoria.
Yeah.
Okay. And who can come?
It's open to the public. Yeah, I think we might have a suggested donation of $10 per evening. There is no child care. We tried to, you know, make that possible, but mm-hmm. it's not going to work.
Is this something that children should not come to?
Yes, this would be educational for
adults.
Parents. There's
caregivers.
This presentation is designed for foster parents, but we're going to tailor it to be more for, you know, general parents and mm-hmm. community members who work with children.
And what about doctors who work with kids?
Absolutely.
Like okay.
Yeah.
So
I mean, really
therapists,
anybody who counselors. Interfaces with families on a professional or obviously personal basis,
okay.
you know, deals with children. It's, you know, I've come of age as a therapist in an age that's heavily influenced by trauma theory. And I would say it's really the rising tide in counseling psychology today. So this is really almost a new way of thinking about mental health issues in child development, which also includes the needs of adults when you review their attachment and trauma histories from childhood. So it's kind of a new lens through which to see mental health problems. And you could say that the DSM, which is the Diagnostic Statistical Manual for Mental Health Disorders, that's the catalog of mental health disorders that are coded, and that's what you'd send to an insurance company. It's a number. Mm-hmm. That's a diagnosis, right? So major depression is a diagnosis, or PTSD is a diagnosis. That comes out of the DSM. There is some new way of looking at this through trauma theory, where you could say that's a very medical model way of looking mm-hmm. at the human experience. And trauma theory is kind of adding another layer to that, which is to say you could have a cluster of symptoms that have been impacted by experiences and attachment disruptions that we would call trauma. Mm-hmm. And then you might look at those medical diagnoses a little bit different.
All right. So let's back up and talk about what is the definition of trauma?
Yeah, and that too is evolving. So trauma used to be, for example, in that the DSM kind of medical model, there's one diagnosis for trauma in the, well, we're actually between two manuals. So in 2013, the most current DSM was published, and they're published very infrequently. We're only on the fifth volume, all told. So you can imagine it's decades between publications. And PTSD and was added into the DSM-4. So PTSD was added because of the needs of Vietnam, returning Vietnam vets. Mm-hmm. And in the DSM-5, there is actually another trauma diagnosis, but still PTSD kind of rules the roost.
Mm-hmm.
So according to that medical model, mm-hmm. A trauma has to be something that was life-threatening, or for a child, they witnessed their caregiver having a life-threatening event. So it could just be perception, that you perceive that your life was at risk, but it does have that. In the medical model, it's really important that it had to have been life-threatening.
That seems very limited.
Exactly.
And, like, no.
Exactly. And also when you look at what havoc is wrought from trauma, such as emotional numbness or having intrusive memories or difficulty sleeping, things like that. Obviously, we've all experienced that when we've been deeply rattled by something and had an emotional experience.
I mean, I think that definition is so inadequate, and it obviously leads to undertreatment, because you can watch TV, go to a movie, and be traumatized. You know darn well that nothing's going to happen to you.
Right.
But it can be traumatizing. You know, watching the Twin Towers come down.
Right.
Again and again. I found so traumatizing that we turned off the cable.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people just turned off TV.
Right.
You know, and just said, I can't do that. Why? Because it was traumatic. It was scary.
And there's a new way of phrasing this, actually, which sounds really kind of rudimentary, and it is. And maybe that's a good thing, to move away from some of the highly technical terms, right? And that is, we talk about small T and big T trauma. So a big T trauma would be somebody who went to Iraq and, you know, was involved with IED explosion, you know, something that was truly horrifying in a life-threatening way. And small T trauma could include things that have to do with maltreatment in childhood or lack of understanding in a crucial developmental stage, or something like a very difficult breakup that you're having a very hard time coping with.
Going back to a childhood event that might happen, when a child is being beaten by their parent, they don't know they're not going to kill them. So in that sense, it probably does qualify as the old trauma.
Yes.
I mean, a kid can't, I mean, maybe that's the perception thing, but the parent could kill the child.
Well, child maltreatment, there's a couple different categories for that. And in fact, this is another, not to make this whole episode about the diagnostic statistical manual, but we're at a critical juncture in mental health treatment right now, in that the new manual has just been published this year. There was an effort by kind of the paterfamilias of the trauma world. Bessel van der Kolk is, he runs a trauma center outside of Boston. And he was advocating, and really there was quite a social movement created to get a complex PTSD diagnosis into that DSM, the current mm-hmm. Edition. And that was to address the very issues you're raising, which are that there's maltreatment that can happen in a very PTSD-like way,
mm-hmm.
which is you were beaten or you had severe, profound neglect. Well, clearly your life was threatened if you were a child and mm-hmm. that was your situation. Mm-hmm. But van der Kolk and company, this really is a social movement that he's sort of spearheaded, brought to the fore that the degree to which you're dependent and the degree to which you're not fully developed yet as a person, that you know, even to understand the context of your situation, is that you could have more mild forms of maltreatment in childhood, such as a parent that isn't understanding mm-hmm. or who is shaming, and you could walk away with symptoms that look like PTSD.
Absolutely.
But you don't meet criteria, and so you can't go to
care.
Mental health treatment and have that covered by insurance at present.
That's insane.
So we work around it.
I see.
Let's just say, don't let that deter you from coming to therapy.
Right. Well, you know, I mean, I think I've seen over the years many people who have what I diagnose as PTSD who've been in car wrecks, who have been in hostage situations, mm-hmm. Like a bank holdup, mm-hmm. or, I mean, lots of people experience all kinds of different, as adults or as children, threats, and they develop mental, emotional problems that I say are a kind of PTSD, and they need to be addressed. They are stuck right there until they fix that.
And I'd like to offer another that is much less vile in most people's minds, which is divorce. And that's something we don't think of as traumatic. Ugh. However,
it's severely traumatic.
Right. And if you work with families in mental health, you know the toll that that takes on children. Now, I mean, what's the percentage of people that divorce?
Over 50%.
So we're kind of inured to it as adults. And of course, many adults have an unfortunate habit of seeing their children through the lens of their fully developed adult brains. Mm. And of course, people who work well with children or people who parent children well understand that they don't see the world the same way that a child sees the world. But something like divorce, we tend to bandwagon, it will be better, you will be fine, daddy and mommy both love you. And we miss the point that the child's world has been completely upended and disrupted in a way that is trauma, as if you were to say a war broke out in the context of adult, you know, ways of seeing things. So mm-hmm. so that is truly destabilizing, and it is a factor of trauma in childhood, and yet how many children go through this?
Most.
Right. Not yeah. considered a life-threatening event.
Right. I think of my two daughters' circle of friends, very few have intact families. Mm-hmm. Most of the boys do not have fathers in their lives. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's pretty startling.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really refreshing to run into a friend whose parents are married.
Yeah.
You know, the whole family's together.
Yeah.
That's pretty grim to think that there's that amount of trauma going on.
Well, and there's a couple other things to mention at this point, maybe. Have you heard of the ACEs study, Adverse Childhood Experiences study?
Oh, is that the one that looks at what the outcomes?
Yes.
Oh, yes.
So it's impossible to have a discussion about child trauma without referencing ACEs. A large HMO, well, it was a Kaiser Permanente in San Diego area in California, in the late 90s, sent out a survey to all of their subscribers, whatever you call HMO.
Policy holders.
Mm-hmm. And it was a very large sample. And they just sent out this survey. It happened to be very well constructed, thank goodness, because the results were startling. And the results show us that childhood trauma is extremely common, tends to cluster, and tends to result in outcomes for the adult person that are linked to substance abuse, high-risk behaviors, health problems, likelihood of having suicidality and depression, and even early death. So the ACEs study was a real game changer in terms of what we know about mm-hmm. the prevalence of child trauma, just like we're talking about now, the small T and the big T. Unfortunately, the tendency to cluster, meaning that many people, I would say probably most people, have a combination of small and big T traumas in their childhood. So then you start to think, well, maybe it's a little bit more of sort of a human condition and caregiver difficulties. Some, I think, are cultural factors, like you're saying about children with divorce. One of the problems with divorce is that what tends to happen is kids spend a lot less time with their parents, because you have two single-parent households.
And the parents are all tired.
Exactly. It doubles the income requirements for maintaining livelihood in two homes, right? So for all kinds of reasons, this sort of has an effect of what's that word? Like kind of a mushroom cloud effect on a child's experience when it comes to trauma. So that disruption could lead to some attachment problems. That could lead to some social problems for the child. That starts to look like behavior problems, emotional problems. Mm-hmm. Then the attachment is even harder to get back on track. And then you start looking at things like, let's medicate for ADHD. Well, that's possibly what's going on, but excuse me, in the face of that much disruption and trauma, that is what needs to be treated. So again, if we take only the medical model, then we're just trying to kind of put out the fire of what that cluster of symptoms results in. We're missing the point of what the ACEs study taught us, which is we know this is going on. We need to treat it for what it is and not just the late stage medical symptom.
Okay, so I just thought of a whole other facet of this. Let's take a break. We come back. We'll talk about a much more widespread problem in our community with children and parents. You are listening to Your Health. I'm with Liz Covey. She's a licensed professional counselor. And if you have a question you'd like to ask and make a comment on, give a call, 325-0010. You're listening to Coast Community Radio. Back, you're listening to Your Health. I'm with Liz Covey. She's a licensed professional counselor at Hope House in Astoria, providing mental health care. Mm-hmm. Well, it is health care for children and families. And we're talking about trauma today. A trauma that a lot of people experience is one parent going away for work or school. Mm-hmm. And
or
I'm
military.
Thinking, well, lots of other things, but working out of town, Coast Guard in our community, Coast Guard, dads or moms gone for months at a time. People who work, fishermen who work in Alaska or out, maybe they're gone for 2 days, but maybe they're gone for 3 weeks. But even those two-day trips or week trips is a disruption in the family. And the parent that goes a lot becomes the undependable parent. The child can't depend on that person anymore because they never know when they're going to be there. Or the parent who goes back to school and gets to a point where they have to go somewhere. They move away. And then they're not there at all.
Right. Yeah, in the world of trauma, and especially working with children and families, you are always working with issues of attachment. So I actually have a subspecialty in attachment trauma, which, again, that is just it's another way to break down sort of how trauma affects children, because everything is in the context of that caregiver, you know, the dyad or triad of parent, child, or child and two parents, not to mention the larger family system. So there's always kind of a systems and attachment approach when you're working with kids.
Instead of just, you're a screwed up kid, we're going to fix you.
Which is the medical model, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's no way to diagnose, I should say, I don't want to get further into that discussion. But yeah, the medical model is highly individualized.
Which really doesn't take into account. And it actually doesn't really address the family dynamics that may be
exactly
causing this child's behavior.
Absolutely. And in fact, that's why there was that movement to address what we call complex PTSD, that movement to include that into, and in fact, mm-hmm. I believe that's why it was not included, is that so many people would be covered under that diagnosis that I could see it actually short-circuiting the whole healthcare system. So if we started to look at families that way, mm-hmm. ACEs studies showed us, boy, everybody could qualify. And that is a legitimate problem.
But not everybody would seek care. I mean, getting people from that, you know, you could benefit from it to them actually getting it.
Right.
It can be years, and some people just will not do it. So, I mean, that might be the safeguard to keep the system from imploding.
Yeah.
Is at least 30% of people will never do anything.
Right. Well, we have a lot of problems in our healthcare system, don't we?
Yes,
but to get back to your point about separations. So in the world of attachment, the buzzword for what we're always working on is building security.
Mm.
So that's the word, right? Now, having secure relationships with a parent or parents, ideally parents, too. We do all have two parents, right?
Mm-hmm. Or more. Some people have more.
Yes, but we do have that, you know, biologically ordained, Right. And then we can have more that actually, you're raising a point, can be very problematic because those other parents tend to come and go more. Step parents, girlfriends, mm-hmm. boyfriends of parents who are divorced or not together.
Mm-hmm.
So
well,
that. So,
well, sometimes older siblings function almost as another parent.
Yes. Very problematic for both children in that
because
scenario.
They're usually old enough that they go too,
right? Yeah. So, and you know, in generally speaking, trauma lodges in one of two ways in the person. Well, I should say it, you know, we're all familiar with the fight, flight, freeze. Well, we're all familiar with fight and flight. Mm-hmm. Freeze is kind of something that the body of research on trauma has added, because actually that I would say is at the heart of the definition of trauma. Is it's difficult emotional material that you have not been able to process out. And how do we process difficult things? Through dreams, through talking to our friends, through, you know, physical experiences, you know, having a good workout after you have a fight feels good, right? So
except
those
if you're a kid, you don't even know that you need to do that.
Right. So instead, we say, let's have you sit at a desk for 9 hours a day. And then, if you have behavioral emotional problems, you'll lose your recess, which might have been your only chance to physically process what's difficult in your life. This is a soapbox of mine that we really need to address the sensory issues with kids. This is not, I shouldn't say this is a soapbox of mine. This is, it comes hand in hand with what the trauma research has shown us, is that for children, trauma is a truly physical experience. I'll tell you, in my office, we are working with foam bats and pillows and putty in our hands and wrapping up tightly in blankets and using, you know, weighted blankets on shoulders and laps. And I mean, it's a highly sensory experience for kids to be working through trauma. So I take great issue with how the schools approach the need to address behavioral and emotional problems through mm-hmm. stillness mm-hmm. and through removal from the social milieu and activity levels. Anyway, to speak to that point about security is to say that it's very, very important that the relationships in the life of a child, especially when there's trauma, but keep in mind, most of us have some kind of trauma. And even if it's a small t, for a young child who has good caregiving, it's still important that their relationships are secure in order for them to not have what we call a big T trauma. So if a parent is coming and going a lot, that should be handled in such a way by the family that the child can come to understand it, such as having rituals around the parting, or such as having pictures and special words that are spoken of about that parent. It also is highly dependent on the developmental stage of the child, how you would approach kind of keeping mm-hmm. that security mm-hmm. there. But it is possible, again, the ideal is that there's a two-parent minimum. I think if you start adding a lot more people, it's not just it takes a village when it comes to parents. It takes a village in the community to raise a child. Mm-hmm. Really, it takes a primary and a secondary parent to develop the apparatus for good attachment. And that is usually the case, that there's one parent that's the close primary parent and one parent that is more the, you know, in a traditional model, this would have been mom and breadwinner dad. Mom's at home, breadwinner dad is out at work. So we're not in that world anymore where that's the norm. And I don't advocate that we should be, but that apparatus is not something we can monkey with. We do need a primary parent who can fully track what's going on with the child emotionally, activities, socially, just really knows the world of the child. And ideally, the secondary parent is the one that's coming and going. If that's not the case, then you have to look at kind of shifting the dynamics to shifting from
Well, most
the
of us are both coming and going.
Right.
We're both, I mean, most two-parent families have both people working, maybe working multiple jobs.
Right.
And, of course, then the kid, when they get to school, then they're coming and going in all their activities. Everybody's running in a million directions.
Yeah. And it's not to say that a parent needs to be at home all the time, but there does need to be ample time to have relationship, to work through problems. And if there is extreme trauma, I mean, this is something we cover early on in treatment with families, which often includes pre-work with the parents, meaning we meet multiple sessions with the parents before I would even meet with a child client.
Mm-hmm.
Because the parents need to learn skills. They need to learn we need to discuss things like, is there ample time together? Mm-hmm. Are there routines and rituals that help to organize the world of the child in a way that promotes security? Because security is not just in relationships, it's also in the structure of how a family functions, as well in a school or in a, you know, in community. So it is crucially important that there is a parent involved and aware enough to build that security. And if that's not the case, you can always count on big T trauma being present.
Mm.
And parents are not interchangeable. I mean, on close inspection, think of the parents you know. There is one who is the primary.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if that's not the case, I suppose there's a possibility of an ideal situation where there's kind of two that are more equally weighted, but it's not my experience that that's what really happens.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But definitely one is primary, and that's a minimum.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe we could add another primary in this kind of ideal discussion, but it doesn't tend to be what happens.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, I definitely found that I was the primary
mm-hmm.
with both kids.
In our culture, it tends to be women. And of course, biologically, right. It tends to be women.
Right, if you're nursing, you're
right.
Connected.
And only one of us gives birth. And you know, mm-hmm. So there's some argument for that being mm-hmm. hardwired.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Although I could see in a two women marriage parenting, there are other options.
Yeah, but still. But in our culture too, being that we need money to survive, even if you are a farmer, you need to sell your goods. It's really just not the case that in our context, it's really not the case that two parents can be as present. So still that traditional model holds, even though the genders might switch. But a greater concern is time with children, and it's not to say that you, as a primary caregiver, can't be employed. I'm a mother, and I will say it's been important for me not to work full time, for example, because my children are still young. So things like that. What kind mm-hmm. of adaptations can a family make? But early on in treatment, I think I was beginning to say. We will discuss with families, if there's not ample time and there has been big T trauma, what can give? And sometimes that is the case that a parent has to take a different kind of work or take a different shift at work in order for there to be time together. Because if you're only together from 6 to 7:30 at night and your child is recovering from trauma, that's not sufficient
mm-hmm.
for the work that's involved.
Mm-hmm. So that's really nice, because that time is something that we can all make happen. You know, if you realize that your child
Hopefully.
Needs more of it, well, yeah, if you want your child to recover, then that's one of the elements. I mean, it makes me think, oh God, all the times when I didn't have enough time for my kids.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a big dilemma. And I'll say it's really a lot of women bear the brunt of this pressure now, because, you know, so many of us work and are the primary caregivers. And it's very important to not choose one or the other as much as that's possible. And mm-hmm. and in the case of extreme trauma, for example, if you have adopted a child or if your child has been abused in some way, it might be the case that you would want to choose being the primary caregiver over employment. But not everyone has the ability to make that choice.
Right. Right, but if you could, or even just work part-time.
Yeah, even in the adoption world or the foster care child welfare world, it is often recommended for kids who've been through, who have many ACEs. And just to say, ACEs are, you actually come out with a you quantify it. So ACEs are, you know, you had a parent who was an alcoholic, you had a parent who went to prison, you know, things like that. You actually get a score. So you can go online. You just Google ACEs.
How do you spell it?
ACES.
Oh, okay.
So Adverse Childhood Experiences Study. And there's a lot out there on this. It's actually been the clearinghouse, I suppose, for promoting research.
So if you get a high score, you're screwed up?
The higher the score,
right.
the more screwed up you're going to be.
Uh-huh. Yeah, although maybe you've worked it out. Maybe you've worked it out. Right.
Well, then you're bringing up the factor of resiliency. Mm-hmm. We used to believe that with children and trauma, that kids bounce back, and it's really good if you have a trauma before you have the ability to remember it. Now we know that's when your nervous system is getting hardwired in the 0 to 3 age range, mm-hmm. and so it's actually much more detrimental to mm-hmm. your long-term health if it's mm-hmm. earlier.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, you have been listening to Your Health. I'm Ann Goldin, and I've been with Liz Covey. She's a licensed
professional
counselor. Sorry. Why don't you give your contact information?
Sure. I can be reached at Hope House. Well, actually, I'll just give my cell phone number because okay. I don't remember the Hope House number offhand. 503-741-1509.
Great. Have a great week. I'm Ann Goldin.